We're spending more time at home than ever before. So now's a great time to finally adopt a dog, right?
Socialization is going to be harder because socialization and social distancing are definitely at odds.
So before you decide to adopt a canine companion during quarantine, listen and subscribe to NPR's Life Kit.
From NPR Music, it's All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. Today, we celebrate the life of the self-proclaimed innovator, originator, and the architect of rock and roll, Little Richard. Little Richard died on May 9th from bone cancer at the age of 87, and what a remarkable life he lived. He broke barriers as a black gay man in the South in the 1950s. His songs changed the course of music. He influenced Elvis Presley, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, Prince, Michael Jackson, David Bowie, and so many, many others. I'm joined by Lauren Onkey. She's the head of NPR Music. And we're going to look at Little Richard's life through the lens of 10 songs. I think one place to start is just assume that somebody who's like 15 or 20 years old isn't going to know Little Richard. If I was a kid of the 60s, it'd be like my dad telling me, hey, somebody from the 1890s just died. You know, it's 70 years. So let's start off with a classic Little Richard, Lauren. What should we play?
There's only one song to play if you're playing to somebody who's never heard of Little Richard, and that is Tutti Frutti.
All right, let's do that. What year is this?
1955. I got a girl named Sue. She knows just what to do. I got a girl named Sue. She knows just what to do. She rock to the west, but she's the gal that I love best. Tutti Frutti, oh Rudy. 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 Oh, wop, bop, loom, bop, lump, bump, bum. I got a gal named Daisy. She almost drives me crazy. Got a gal named Daisy. Yes, indeed. Boy, you don't know what you do to me. Tutti Frutti, oh Rudy. 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 Bop, 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 bop.
You can't help it. Let's paint a picture. 1955. What's going on in music? Just help people understand where this song fit in, Lauren.
So in 1955, rock and roll is starting to come together. This music that is really for young people and really louder and faster and more about them than probably any other music that had ever existed. It was not for adults, although it was about often about sex, but it was aimed at young people. Chuck Berry had had his first hit with Maybelline earlier that year. Fats Domino had been having hits for a number of years, a piano player out of New Orleans. Elvis Presley was just starting to kind of burst out on the national scene. So there was already some idea that rock and roll was a thing, but it hadn't quite fully taken over. And in some ways, 1955 is the year of the earthquake, you know, of the Big Bang or whatever kind of metaphor you want to use. It's also America is legally segregated at the time. And Richard Penniman, the birth name of Little Richard, who's born in Georgia, is born in the segregated South and records Tutti Frutti in New Orleans in the segregated South. So, you know, again, for people that might not know, the radio stations were segregated, right. Playlists were segregated, you know. But the fun thing about radio is that you can segregate and divide people about where you put them, but people could still move the dial. Yeah, and so a kid who, you know, in fact, Little Richard used to make this joke that young white kids would leave out the records of people like Pat Boone, who covered him and very famously on Tutti Frutti, and then keep the Little Richard record under the bed, you know? So there was a way in which the music was subversive, certainly of racial lines at that time.
Tutti Frutti as a lyric on the face of it is, someone would say, well, what are you talking about? Like raucous and sex, like about what it's like fruit or something. I mean, what is going on here?
It really doesn't matter what the words are. It's the energy and just that opening, a wop, bop, a loo wop, right? Little Richard's songs sound to me like you've taken a Coke bottle and just shaken it up, you know? Like the thing is just really explosive in a way that does not sound tame. The delivery, the whole spirit around it, the screaming.
Let's play Long Tall Sally at the top of 1956.
Go to town and marry about Uncle John. He claimed he has a misery, but he's having a lot of fun. Oh, baby. Yes, baby. Woo, baby. Having me some fun tonight. Yeah. Well, Long Tall Sally, she's a biblical species guy. Everything that Uncle John needs, oh, baby. And he ducked back in the alley, oh, baby. Yes, baby. Ooh, baby. Having me some fun tonight. Yeah.
I haven't heard these songs in an awfully long time. And 65 years old, these songs are. And it still holds up for me. I'd be curious to talk to somebody who's 18, 17 years old. It feels undeniable.
And it's 2 minutes.
Right.
I think Long Tall Sally is 207 or something like that. Part of it is the musicians, too. I mean, he's playing with these incredible musicians out of New Orleans. Earl Palmer on drums, who's one of the most important drummers in the history of rock and roll. You hear that great low sax sound, Lee Allen. There's just great playing, and it's designed to get people excited. You can't not dance to it, it seems to me. And, you know, that's not the music of my period. I'm not a kind of first generation rock and roller, but it's just designed to excite people. And you hear in that song, you hear, and really in Tutti Frutti, everything that Little Richard is, you get those high woo, which is something he pulls out of gospel music. You've got the incredible driving piano, kind of nonsensical lyrics, but the sex is a little more explicit here with Uncle John and Long Tall Sally getting to it in the alley until Aunt Mary comes along. But it's just how to get people to kind of respond. It still feels like a record to me that just kind of grabs me by the collar.
I was thinking about that 2-minute thing that we were just saying. Mm. I think this whole playlist of 10 songs is probably under 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And then when in the late 70s, when punk came along and songs were 2 minutes long, I forgot that that generation before me was listening to music that was basically in the 2-minute range. And you can pack an awful lot into 2 minutes. And he did.
I was thinking about punk today and thinking about the legacy of Little Richard in music. And I would put punk in that line. You know, it's funny, like sometimes people used to tell this story about the beginning of rock and roll, like R&B meets country music and out you get rock and roll. And that's really only true sort of out of Memphis where Elvis Presley comes and Carl Perkins. I mean, there's all these things happening in the mid 50s that get called rock and roll. They're quite different. Like New Orleans doesn't quite sound like what's happening in Chicago. New York with doo-wop groups is a different thing, but it's all focused on kind of energy and youth.
And at this time period, he's grown up in the South. Let's walk backward a little bit. I think there's a story, and you would know this story if it were true, that Sister Rosetta Tharpe heard him sing in the late 40s, around 1947. He was a teenager, probably 13, 14 years old. And she invited him to open for her at one of her shows in, I think it's called the Macon City Auditorium. His father was a preacher. He was one of how many children?
12, I think.
Yeah. His body was, he had one leg a little bit shorter than another, which caused, as kids do, a lot of people giving him a hard time. He was effeminate. I mean, he'd wear women's makeup and stuff around the house. His father threw him out of the house around the age of 15. Talk about his early life a little bit more.
And he loved music and learned music through the church and took a lot of the rhythms out of the church and certainly the singing, a lot of the singing, you know, that we think of as rock and roll singing is gospel singing. You know, those high sounds often are attributed to the great singer Marion Williams that Little Richard cited so many times. He used to talk about a guy, Brother Joe May, who was also a really big influence on him and how he put himself out in the world. But by the time he left home, he was also singing in minstrel shows and kind of vaudeville kind of things and gospel, just
like singing Caledonia in a medicine show or something, right?
Yeah, he could be singing R&B, but he could also be around, in strip clubs and just this world of kind of daily entertainment, right? But he loved R&B and really wanted to have a recording career. And he starts to record in the early 50s and, you know, he's a great piano player. He's a good singer, but there's just nothing distinctive about it.
You're talking about stuff pre-Tutti Frutti.
Pre-Tutti Frutti in the early 50s. They're fun R&B records, but when you hear his early 50s stuff, it's okay. It's not bad, but it's not somebody who's going to break out of the pack, you know?
Let's play something. What do you want to play?
Let's play Get Rich Quick from 1952, one of his earliest records on RCA.
Gonna get rich quick. This is my lucky day. So stick around, baby, and everything will be okay.
good.
It's fun. If you were in a bar or out dancing or something, that would sound great, but it wouldn't jump out from so many other things.
And wasn't a hit.
Nope, it was not a hit. And, you know, he had a number of records like that in the early 50s. And what he was seeing in, you know, strip clubs and medicine shows and, you know, drag shows, and he was influenced by some African-American great performer in the 50s, Escarita. It gave him a lot of his look, his gender-bending look. By the time he got to New Orleans, you know, he was really, he looked really interesting and unique at that time. His hair up really high and sometimes wearing makeup and his cool thin mustache. But he was sniffing out what was happening out of New Orleans with Fats Domino Records. And so he ends up recording at a famous studio in New Orleans, J&M.
Did he go to New Orleans specifically to record? And was it people like Fats Domino that got him there?
Well, he had signed with Specialty Records at that point, and Specialty was recording a lot of people in New Orleans. So let's do the flip side of Long Tall Sally. So imagine this, right? A and B.
One second. Yep. A flip side for anyone who doesn't know. Because you would buy 45s. They were discs about 7 inches big that would have two sides to them. And one was the A side and one was the B side, called the flip side. Keep going.
That's
I'm
right.
Sorry.
So the single that you heard on the radio was Long Tall Sally. That was the A side. You flip the record over and Slippin' and Slidin' was the other side of that record. So for about 49 cents... you got two incredible early rock and roll songs. So this is also from early 56.
Wasn't sitting at that piano. Right?
No, he was a really exciting performer, standing at the piano always in those days and moving around and dancing. And he had a great band known as the Upsetters and lots of horns. There aren't any 1950s live performances on film of Little Richard. We don't have any, unfortunately.
Wow.
Little Richard was not on the Ed Sullivan Show. You know, one of the things that happens is rock and roll really explodes and becomes very popular with white kids is that there's definitely an interest in limiting exposure of African-American artists to white kids. So, like, Bo Diddley is on the Ed Sullivan Show really early. Fats Domino's on the Steve Allen Show. These were variety shows in the 50s. But once rock and roll really gets big, you don't see African-American artists there, 56, 57. So the footage that we have of Little Richard is from the movies where he's lip-syncing, right? So you're hearing the record and he's mouthing the words.
Maybe he has his foot up on the piano as he's...
Right. And I think the best picture we can get is this cool film called Mr. Rock and Roll. And there's Little Richard. It's a black and white film with his whole band behind him. And he's lip-syncing Lucille, and he's got makeup on, and he's jumping around. And even when he's just mouthing the words to the record, you just get a little taste of how big and powerful the band was, right? And how exciting he would have been.
Would he have toured? Like, what was life like as a musician who started having hit singles on the air?
Yeah, Little Richard would have definitely toured. One of the most important ways that rock and roll artists toured at that time was the Alan Freed touring shows and the Alan Freed shows at the Paramount Theater in New York. Alan Freed was a radio disc jockey. It started out in Cleveland, and he was playing pretty much all African-American music on his
show
in Cleveland as a white DJ, which was really unusual. And he started to put these package shows together where you could go and see 10 acts or something, right? Because, of course, these songs are short and you would have just, you know, been able to see one act after another. One thing to note there, though, is that when those bands and those tour packages went through the South, they were playing to segregated audiences. And there are really interesting posters that still exist from the 50s that show two different prices for whites and African Americans. So it's listed as, you know, whites $3, colored $2.50, and they would have been segregated, say, floor to balcony, or the audiences would have been segregated like down the middle of the floor.
And when those audiences start to mingle, because they eventually did, that's a huge breakthrough. I mean, it's part of why music was so culturally important to the racial segregation that existed and opening up the culture and the mingling of cultures and the understanding of one another, and all that stuff happens because of things like Tutti Frutti. And it's crazy to think about. You certainly never would have imagined it, but it really did. And so a lot of people hated this music, this Negro music, as it was often called, and worse, it really shook up the culture.
And white supremacists knew the power of the music to bring people together in what to them would have been a threatening way. I mean, there's handbills that still exist. For example, like the New Orleans Klan, you know, has these handbills about don't let your kids listen to this music. So, you know, Little Richard is out there in that world. I think it's important for us to hear these records as a threat.
Let's take a break. I'm talking with Lauren Onkey, head of NPR Music. We're talking about Little Richard, and you're listening to All Songs Considered from NPR Music.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who specialize in issues such as isolation, depression, stress, anxiety, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment when you need professional help. Get help at your own time and your own pace. Schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. Visit betterhelp.com/songs to learn more and get 10% off your first month. The following message comes from our sponsor, Jack Daniel's. Master distiller Jeff Arnett explains the crucial step in the process that makes Jack Daniel's a Tennessee whiskey and not just a bourbon.
A very unique feature of the Jack Daniel distillery is the charcoal mellowing area. And this is where you see all the vats that are 10 feet deep with charcoal. You know, as the whiskey works its way through that charcoal, it's removing a lot of the bitterness that's inherent in the spirit. And the whiskey that comes out the bottom is light and it's sweet.
To learn more about Jack Daniel's Tennessee whiskey, go to jackdaniels.com. Please drink responsibly.
It's All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. I'm here with Lauren Onkey. We're talking about Little Richard. How about we play The Girl Can't Help It, and then you come back and talk about it.
Great.
Come well done.
Can't help it, girl can't help it.
She made grandpa feel like 21.
Can't help it, the girl can't help it.
The girl can't help it, she was born to please. Can't help
it. She makes beefsteak be well done.
Now, this is not the same recording sessions as done in New Orleans, right?
Right. This song is later in 56, and it's the title track to a movie that came out of the same name. And the movie was in color as opposed to black and white, which, you know, wasn't true of a lot of 50s films. And the star of the film is Jane Mansfield, who's this blonde bombshell. And the movie opens with this famous scene of her really just kind of eating up the screen. She's so sexy, and that's the song. And there's a great interview with Paul McCartney of the Beatles describing seeing that in the movie theater and the combination of the Little Richard track and her being as sexy as she was. He was like, that is the coolest thing I've ever seen. I want to be part of that. But I think the track is a little slicker than what you heard from the year before. He didn't write this song. It was written by an LA songwriter, maybe that did a lot for Hollywood too, Bobby Troup. And it's fun, and the lyrics are very Little Richard, but it's not quite as edgy, I think, as some of the other records.
It's funny you make a point here that even back then, music in movies had a huge impact.
I think movies were a key way that people got to see early rock and rollers. And Alan Freed was the DJ who we talked about, was also in a lot of these movies. There was a series of Alan Freed movies with all of these rock and roll stars. And, you know, the plots are ridiculous, right? It's like the kids are going to put on a dance and they want to bring the rock and roller to town and the PTA doesn't want them to, and they're going to beat those. Yay. And then Little Richard comes on the stage. But if you were 14, how cool to be able to see these really young, exciting artists on the big screen on a Saturday afternoon at the movie theater.
Because they're not likely to come to your town and you're too young, even if they did.
Right.
And your parents might not let you.
Right. So the movies are this entree, too.
Yeah. Back in those days, you didn't go but a handful of months without a new single, right? I mean, you needed to be constant. 1957, Little Richard puts out this song. I think the name is kind of obvious, so here comes.
So that song was a number one hit on the R&B charts in 57. It hit, I think, 21 on the pop charts and was a really, really a breakthrough song for him in England, where rock and roll was also breaking. The thing that always strikes me about that song is just how unbridled his voice is. You know, we talked about punk before. Yeah. Like, that vocal is just, like, it's just pushing the microphone and just creating such edge. I feel like it feels to me like the recording studio can't keep that sound in there. Like, you know, he's just going to burst out of there. Just the timbre of his voice right up against the limits. It doesn't feel like a fancy recording in that way. It's just like he's just pushing it so hard.
In the summer of 57, Little Richard's on a roll, and he puts out this song. Let's play Keep a Knockin'. And you want to tell us what to listen for?
All you need to listen for is the opening drum track. I don't know that there's a more exciting rock and roll record, even though I just said that about Tutti Frutti.
Here we go then.
Keep a knockin', but you can't come in. Keep a knockin', but you can't come in. Keep a knockin', but you can't come in. Come back tomorrow night and try it again. You said you love me and you can't come in. You said you love me and you can't come in. Woo! You said you love me and you can't come in. Come back tomorrow night and try it again. Woo! Keep a knockin', but you can't come in. Keep a knockin', but you can't come in. Keep a knockin', but you can't come in. Come back tomorrow night and try it again. You said you love me and you can't come in. You said you love me and you can't come in. Woo! You said you love me and you can't come in. Come back tomorrow night and try it again. Woo! Keep a knockin', but you can't come in. Keep a knockin', but you can't come in. Woo! Keep a knockin', but you can't come in. Come back tomorrow night and try it again. You said you love me and you can't come in. You said you love me and you can't come in. You said you love me and you can't come in. Come back tomorrow night and try it again. Woo!
You know, it's fun to talk about rock and roll, but you really need to dance to records like that or just move around your house. We're all stuck at home right now. Crank some Little Richard and cook dinner. You know, that music just is so physical.
I'm going to clean my entire apartment today. Top to bottom, Little Richard. It's going to help me. In this summer of 57, by the fall of 57, he goes on a world tour, goes to Australia, gets on a plane with the likes of Eddie Cochran and Gene Vincent, and kind of something happens, kind of scares the hell out of him. As I understand it, that there's some weirdness on the plane, and he envisions like angels holding up the plane and made it safely to the ground. Do you know, is that story, am I right?
A legend, right? Yeah, but right. He certainly reports that he has some vision in that experience that tells him that he should really turn back to God and devote his life to God and give up this lifestyle, this rock and roll thing that he's been doing. I mean, you know, he was living pretty edgy. You know, he's pushing all kinds of boundaries musically, sexually, in terms of racial boundaries. I think they partied pretty hard on the road, all the band members from Little Richard's band would talk about. So after that, he only records gospel music. And he goes to his religious education, kind of Bible school in Alabama, I think. And he records a number of things. None of them are great. And, you know, I love gospel music, but there's not a lot of the stuff that Richard's recording in that period that really shines out. And, you know, by all accounts, and, you know, he remained devout and a Christian the rest of his life. I mean, I went to see him in 2009 and they were handing out some flyers with some information about his faith and what he wanted people to believe. So this was a you know, a constant in his life. But for this period, he was really, that's all he was doing. But you almost get the sense on the records that he's hiding the previous Little Richard, just sonically. And I picked one track from the second gospel record, which also has a kind of a rock and roll title, which is Pray Along with Little Richard, Volume 2, which followed Pray Along with Little Richard, Volume 1. It's a song called Every Time I Feel the Spirit, which doesn't really sound like Little Richard. I mean, what you're almost looking for when you go to that music, I think, is the whooping and the passion and the intensity, but for the Lord. And you get something more constrained. If we played an old Marion Williams record that Little Richard loved, it would sound unbridled at certain points. But yeah. Here, you know, he's in a different mode. And the first wave of rock and roll has kind of receded just a little bit by the late 50s in this same period, and that some of the big stars have come off the scene. Elvis goes into the army, famously. Chuck Berry is arrested. So there's some, you know, rock and roll itself, and I think, is also being pulled back just a little bit too. But then late 62, early 63, he wants to go back out and play his hits again. We're seeing this music come out of England, and he actually tours with the Beatles. He's on a package tour. He's leading a package tour. I don't know how he gets there. I'm not enough of a Richard, Little Richard expert, but
I do know that Brian Epstein, the Beatles manager at the time, the Beatles are not the international famous group, gets them. The Beatles are not the headline act, right?
That's right. Yeah. This is before the Beatles come to the United States. They've started to have hits in England in late 62 and early 63. And Little Richard was one of their heroes. They played Little Richard music in their club dates, and now they were on a bill with Little Richard. And the Beatles record Long Tall Sally and also Kansas City, Hey, 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 which Little Richard had recorded. So they love Little Richard, and Paul really gets that Little Richard vocal style, something he loves very much. But there's a track of them covering Little Richard's song, Oh My Soul, that they recorded on the BBC, and it's in 1963. So again, before they come to America, before they've really hit, and it's got a really cool energy to it. So you can feel Little Richard's impact on them.
Great. Let's hear the Beatles from the BBC. It's 1963.
Oh, my soul. Well, baby, 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 baby. Don't you know my love is true? Honey, 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 honey. Say, get up off that money. I love, 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 love. Oh, my soul. Well, gimme, 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 gimme. Gimme all the love you got. Baby, 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 baby.
You know, I think for like my generation completely learned about Little Richard through the Beatles. I mean, it was the back door into a music that was, in my case, my sister's generation and not mine. Boy, it's the same thing. I mean, it's so infused with Little Richard.
The Beatles are so close to that first generation of rock and roll, you know, because they start playing in bands in the 50s. I mean, the big difference is it's not driven by piano and sax, right? Piano was so important at the beginning of rock and roll. People like Fats Domino and Jerry Lee Lewis and Little Richard, they're piano players. The Beatles are the drivers for making guitars the rock and roll instrument, but they're so important in there.
And then what happens to Little Richard?
He continues to record. But like so many of those first generation rockers, like, he doesn't really ever have another huge hit again. It's funny, those guys were still so young. Elvis, Fats Domino, Little Richard, they're like still in their late 20s, right? In the 60s. But I mean, you experienced it.
I did.
More. They must have felt like from another time, yeah?
Totally. And so you could just look at the hairstyles to begin with, right? Because that was really different. And things changed so much in that early 1960s. Identity and generation are so connected that I wanted nothing to do with the older generation's music. I wanted my music. I wanted my generation's music. And when you turned on the radio in 1964, 65, you're not going to hear a Little Richard. They just didn't play that stuff. And there was no classic rock station. I mean, there wasn't.
Right.
There was nothing that looked back. That radio in those days was what is happening right now in this week, basically, or this month. I mean, the charts were, they changed every week. And that's what you heard. You didn't hear the songs that were out even 4 months back. It just moved forward so fast and furious. And I never heard Little Richard on the regular rock and roll radio in New York City when I grew up.
And now we're used to rock stars who have decade-long careers, right? But that certainly wasn't the idea then. It's like they were the past. And but you know, he tours, he's recording. He's so flamboyant. Little Richard always knew how important he was, and he had this great public shtick on, say, TV talk shows and stuff when he would, you know, talk about himself as the originator of rock and roll. So, you know, I think he became a public personality in a way in the 60s and 70s. But there are some gems along the way. One song I pulled that's really unusual for his sound, it really sounds right in the center of 60s soul. It's called "I Don't Know What You Got," from 1965. Don Covey wrote the song, who was a great soul songwriter. Otis Redding could have sung that song. Otis was a big Little Richard fan, but it doesn't sound like what we think of as Little Richard, right?
Right, but that could have fit on the radio at any point. I'm surprised it didn't, and I'm sure the politics and the payola and I don't know what kept that off the radio, but that's a good one.
But part of it might have been what you said, Bob, which is those guys didn't seem cool.
Yeah, there is that. We talked so much earlier on about Little Richard. We think about his influence. We talk about the Beatles. I look at Little Richard videos today and can only see Prince, right? There's the flamboyant nature, the clothing, the hair, and the sexuality. Where is it? It's both male and female in this one human.
Yeah, and when in the 50s, when Little Richard breaks, you know, he had come out of, we talked about his early days, he's learning from people doing drag shows, you know, he himself is bisexual, gay.
Not words that were used in the 1950s.
Not words that were used in those days, and he certainly wouldn't have been framed in that way. He would have been maybe talked about privately in that way, right? And so when we think about moments like him giving up rock and roll in 57, you know, what is he grappling there with in terms of his sexual identity too, and in a culture where he couldn't be out?
And where his father threw him out of the house for being effeminate, as we would have said back then.
But when he, you know, when he comes back in the 60s and especially the late 60s, I think he plays up that look of kind of gender fluidity, and the makeup gets more dramatic, the wigs are more dramatic. I mean, he kind of embraces psychedelia in some ways and sets the stage for glam rock in the 70s. I mean, David Bowie has talked about him as an influence, and we think about bands like T-Rex. So the way in which he messes with boundaries, always messed with boundaries, I think is been important in a lot of different eras of rock and roll. And you see it in the 70s in particular, when mainstream rock is really messing around with gender. He signs with Reprise Records, and he records a few albums in the early 70s that have a lot of great songs on them. They're all over the place. They've got too many musicians on them. You know, it's a big session, but there's some really great tracks. And the one song that's his last song that charted, called Freedom Blues, this came out in 1970. And it's written with Escarita, who I mentioned earlier was a really important influence on Richard early on. It's from an album called The Real Thing, R-I-L-L.
This is wonderful. I learned so much. There's a playlist on Spotify you've put together, which is more songs than this.
Yeah, you can find the playlist on the NPR Music site, as well as a number of remembrances there to really dig into Little Richard. And for a guy that really only had 2 years of intense recording and hits, he has been influential throughout rock and roll and soul and R&B music. His image, his sound, he symbolizes a lot of freedom.
That's beautiful. Thank you, Lauren.
Thanks, Bob.
That's Lauren Onkey, head of NPR Music. We celebrated the life of Little Richard. There's more on the NPR Music site. Little Richard died of bone cancer. He was 87 years old. Wow. For NPR Music, let's go out on Freedom Blues. I'm Bob Boylan. It's All Songs Considered.
I hope that I should live to see when every man